Thank you, Senator Baker. Now it's my privilege to introduce the Senate Minority Leader, Senator Robert C. Byrd, who has served 3 terms in the House of Representatives before being elected to the Senate from West Virginia in 1958. He's been the Minority Leader since 1981 and had become Majority Leader in 1977 and served as Majority Whip in 71 through 77. Committees of which he is an important member include
machine, which I have, and I'd like to know now whether the tone of voice you hear is adequate to reach those in the back row. If it's not, raise your hand. All right, now, I'm going to take you on for what the French call this morning a tour d'horizon, which means, as you, even if you don't speak French, understand, it's a tour of the whole horizon in foreign policy. And my qualifications are that I spent over 4 years in the Army as a staff officer, seeing the world in World War II, literally the world in every theater of operation. And I spent 32 years in the House and Senate, the greater part of that on the committees of each house, which deals with the foreign policy of our country. And I need to tell all of you, you wouldn't be in political science classes if you weren't interested and involved. And foreign policy is no longer a striped pants business. It's the business of everybody. Because I'm sure you, just like I, and many, many other millions, are worried about whether right now we're too trigger happy and whether the strains between us and the other superpower, the Soviet Union, are so great as to give what the defense artists like to call as a window of vulnerability, which they use in terms of alleged inadequate defenses of the United States, but which really means that in this atmosphere, when the superpowers are not talking intimately, anything can happen, and any lunatic can make it happen. So this is everybody's very pressing business. I shall not intend to impose my ideas and my opinions on you. I'll let you judge that for yourself. I have them, very deep ones, as you will see. But I shall only try to impart to you things that I've learned and consideration that you must have before you. Let us remember that we live in a very unhomogenized world and mark the un. This is not the same universe we would like. There are lots of very stubborn people who have very different ideas than we do, and are just as convinced as we are of their being the right course. To give you an example, Americans have a very clear idea. For we are essentially a moral and a religious people. And among 235 million, there are lots of exceptions. But preponderantly, we are a moral and a religious people. So to us, human rights mean free speech, free association, speaking your mind, voting, and having a right to contend against an omnipresent government at any level, local or national. To the Soviet Union, human rights mean something very different. Human rights mean a house to live in, food to eat, a job, and an orderly community, and in most cases, a cooperative. In the old Marxian sense, from those who can give to the limit of their talents, for the benefit of all who must receive. And to them, that's just as moral as our definition of human rights. And let's remember, too, that they were serfs up until the middle of the 19th century. And let's remember, too, that they lost 20 million dead in World War II. And let's remember, too, that they were invaded in the aftermath of the revolution with the intent of suppressing their revolution. And let's remember that even we agree they had a right to revolt against Tsarism, the complete dictatorship of one spoiled man or woman. And this is very hard for us to take and to reflect in our diplomacy. I had the privilege in the war of commanding a battalion of troops in training. I always told them, gentlemen, don't forget that even people who are scared to death shoot to kill. We must understand that. Sure, the Russians are scared. Sure, they're paranoid. And sure, we understand their paranoia. But those bullets are just as lethal as if they were high-minded patriots of democracy and freedom. Now, these are probably the most important things that I'm telling you today. I'll give you a lot of detail, but what I've told you is the nubbin of the question. We're dealing with a confused, troubled, essentially poor world of people. And dealing with that, and yet with our own strong feelings about human rights, takes a lot of thinking, a lot of restraint, and a lot of understanding. And that's foreign policy. And that's diplomacy. Now, get to the details. First and foremost, we need a thinking USA. We are the locomotive of the world's economy. We are also the safest place in the world. I believe we have the best system, perhaps best expressed in Churchill's words, democracy is the worst form of government except for any other that we know about. He was right. And you can't force around here. You can only persuade. And that's the way it ought to be. And I would say to you, as students, that the proudest words in the English language ought to be the words, "I am persuaded." It takes a lot of good quality and good character to be able to say that. Now, the key to the Soviet despotism in its external form, and that's the only form that ought to interest us, everything else would go by the axiom of my father, who wanted to turn aside from an argument and would end it by saying, in his native Yiddish, "He should hit his head on the wall. Don't bother me." And that's the way we ought to feel about what forms the internal government of a country may take, provided that it doesn't imperil our values and our chosen system. So the key to the Soviet danger, as far as we're concerned, is something called the Brezhnev Doctrine. Brezhnev being the General Secretary of the Soviet Union's Communist Party before the current man, Chernenko. That doctrine says that whenever the Soviet Union believes that any Communist Party in any country is being thwarted or suppressed or denied its opportunity to take over, then the Soviet Union reserves the right to intervene in any manner, including the use of force. And of course, that's what's happened in blatant cases like Afghanistan, and what's happened also in more subtle cases like we experience in Vietnam in the 60s and the early 70s. Now, contrasted with that doctrine, which we cannot accept, obviously, the Reagan doctrine. Reagan's doctrine was expressed in peace through strength. Peace through strength. The theory being that if you're strong, no one will dare to attack you. And unfortunately, the word strength, by those who use it so freely, is not equated with social and economic strength, but it's primarily military strength. That equation is too simplistic because there are so many other factors included in what might induce attack. The Korean airliner tragedy is a very good example. Any lunatic can push a button if he's in control, i.e. Gaddafi of Libya. He doesn't have to have a reason. And he doesn't have to have any strength but military or financial in terms of subversion and bribery to have a dangerous relationship to peace. Now, I am the author of something called the War Powers Resolution, which is intended to restrain our presidents from the use of military force improvidently. It proposes that the power to use our armed forces in hostilities abroad should be shared with the Congress. And that was an innovation 200 years after the founding of this republic. But it's a very salutary one, because the power to declare war is exclusively vested by the Constitution and the Congress, not the President. And that's the way it was designed, as Jefferson testified in his day. The importance of that restraint is based upon the uncertainties which are created by fear, headstrong action, ambition, and other human factors when you're dealing with men and women that have so much power as our president has in his role as commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Now, and that's our situation. We found out that the Russians are not ignorant logiques. They know how to make an atom and a hydrogen bomb and a Sputnik and spacecraft. And tomorrow, space weapons. So this, the business of their backwardness is no longer true. And again, that's a fact of life, not a theory. Therefore, to think that we're gonna beat them down by massive preparation is nonsense. At the same time, as I told you before, to think that they may not blunder for whatever reason into some hostility anywhere is childish. Whether it's fear or whether it's the design of those who may dream of world dominion in the Kremlin or whatever. It could happen here, and therefore reasonable military provisions against these contingencies are quite proper, so long as we remain where we are. But that doesn't mean that we can get superiority or intimidate them by greater preparation and therefore great opportunities to reduce the level of danger, like commitments against the first use of atomic weaponry, ratifying treaties which are sitting on the shelf, which reduce these armaments, and encouraging relationships generally called détente in scientific, medical, social, commercial affairs, which bring people in more contact and more useful contact. A clear understanding of our allies and friends in Western Europe, which remains the linchpin of the security of the free world, the understanding of the grave problems of poverty and ignorance and ill health in the third world, so-called, the developing countries with per capita incomes of $600 to $1,200 a year compared with our $13,000. These become very strong factors in what's going to happen. And when you're as rich as we are, relatively speaking, it's like the beauty of one's wife. It's always compared to home. Still plenty of trouble in our own country, but relatively. We're very rich, and we have to be very cognizant that riches is not only pleasure, but heavy responsibility. For example, I spent 2 years of my life as a senator trying to get the United States to ratify the SALT II Treaty with the Soviet Union on the reduction of nuclear armaments. And what could be described in our term as a revolt by the middle class of our country, which has a right to be heard. And if it has the majority to prevail, I don't contest that. But what happened was that instead of ratifying that treaty and putting us on the road to yet another treaty to be called SALT III, we failed to ratify because the politics of the country was against it. And it contained the basic structure for SALT III. And we've now fumbled that ball completely. Yet, in a strange anomaly, both we and the Soviet Union agreed to comply with SALT II, even though the Senate failed to ratify. But we are complying. And as far as we can tell, they are complying. Now that's up in 85. Question. Will we continue? Or will we turn loose more of the dogs of war by abandoning that effort? Nobody knows. I believe we'll continue. Or that we'll make a new treaty in 85. But nobody knows. And this is not that's not going to be the end of it a year from now. I'm sure some of you facing me in 10 or 20 years will be in the same positions of authority that I was, and that you'll have the enormous privilege of teaching and leading our people in these decisions, unless again some lunatic decides to blow up the world. I'm optimistic enough to believe that's not likely to happen, notwithstanding the dim view we take now. Now, I have one other observation to make. These finite matters to which I've referred are matters of degree. And therefore, they're not black and white. and they're unlikely to be. They're all going to be fuzzy. Let me give you an example. In the Western Hemisphere, we've had a good many military governments. We have some now, like Chile. And in other parts of the world, we've had communist governments. Most evident, aside from the so-called Eastern bloc of the Warsaw Pact, is Cuba, Nicaragua, Angola, etc. Now, it's easy to say the United States tolerates military governments. Why has it got such a hex on Nicaragua? There is a difference. It is a fact that military governments within the area and climate of Western influence have been removed, i.e. Argentina, or have given way, i.e. Brazil. And it is a fact that the communist system fastens a stranglehold on governments which go over that way, which so far cannot be undone. This is a very serious question for our country. On the other hand, going in doused, such governments are either, it is either impractical, i.e. Poland, or Hungary, or Czechoslovakia, or it cannot be done on the ground that the people are really for it. So what do? We have to live with them. That doesn't mean we approve of them. But we must do our utmost to create a climate in the world which makes it much more attractive for the people involved themselves to move in a direction of more democracy and freedom. The best example of that, to my mind, is Mexico, which could easily go into a totalitarian direction were it not for the enormous efforts of the United States and the Western world in trade, in aid, in peace, and many, many other forms of cooperation, which may now extend even to the very vexing immigration problem. And so, another added factor is enormous patience and the pressure, what you would call it, international affairs, peer pressure. That's why the efforts of the Contadora group, which is trying to bring about a position of peace in Central America, and which consists of Mexico, Panama, Venezuela, and Colombia, is so critical, and why we are failing, as many in the Congress properly contend, to use adequately for peace purposes the Organization of American States, the OAS, the peace agreement and mutual security agreement, which the Organization of American States has called the Rio Pact, which was intelligently employed in the Dominican Republic in the 60s, and why we are failing to use the intermediation of countries like Argentina and Brazil in order to relieve the strain in Central America instead of trying to break the back right away, quick, without patience of the Nicaraguan government to move on. I've mentioned to you before the importance of Western Europe. The central theme of the the central theme of Soviet foreign policy is to win away Western Europe from the United States. It's called the Finlandization of Europe, because it's not an effort to take it by force, but it is an effort to isolate it and scare it with the SS-20 missile, which is deployed in the Soviet Union. And therefore, to get it to be a willing puppet of the Soviet Union, like East Germany, which is essentially a Western-oriented country. And the secondary objective of Soviet diplomacy is to establish hostility between Africa and the Middle East, including the Arab-Israel conflict, keeping that hot and burning, and depriving, therefore, the West of influence and trade in the developing countries of Africa and Asia, and finally to make us uneasy in our own backyard with Cuba and Nicaragua and other areas if possible. There was nothing deadly about all that. But it's real competition. And it's the real thing. And could be extremely dangerous to undermine our system. I'm going to tell you finally, and I think it's all I can do today, one illustrative story. A very wonderful senator and I wrote what's called the Taiwan Relations Act. And his name was Frank Church of Idaho, unhappily. He's much younger than I am and died here recently. The key to that law, which is worth your reading, was not that the United States would come to the aid of Taiwan if the People's Republic of China threatened to take it over. What it was, and only what it was that the social and economic system of Taiwan would not be in danger. Both sides agree that Taiwan is part of China, but we wouldn't tolerate 16 million productive people being subverted against their will, not by the government which administers the country, but by the society and the economy that country is permitted to operate under. And we did not promise force on the contrary. We rejected force, but we would sustain them with diplomacy and business relations and money and trade and the most powerful weapon of all in international affairs, the weapon that's called support, backing, encouragement, confidence. Thank you very much.
Montez.
Bonjour, docteur. Bonjour, docteur.
Je ne suis pas le docteur. Je ne suis pas le docteur. Je ne suis que le palier. Je ne suis que le palier.
Bonjour, docteur. Bonjour, docteur.
Je ne suis pas le docteur. Je ne suis pas le docteur. Je suis une table d'opération. Je suis une table d'opération.
Bonjour, docteur. Bonjour, docteur.
Je ne suis pas le docteur. Je ne suis pas le docteur. Je suis la salle de consultation. Je suis la salle de consultation. Je ne suis pas le docteur. Je ne suis pas le docteur. Je suis le dortoir des malades. Je suis le dortoir des malades. Je suis une pauvre chaise. Je suis une pauvre chaise. Je ne suis rien du tout. Je ne suis rien du tout. Je suis le lit du malade. Je suis le lit du malade. Je suis l'oreiller. Je suis l'oreiller.
Bonjour, docteur. Bonjour, docteur.
Je ne suis plus le docteur. Je ne suis plus le docteur. Je viens de démissionner. Je viens de démissionner.
Ah, voici Marie-Jean.